Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your host for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week on our website and podcast, helping you stay up to date with market moves, stuff that's happening in the metals sector, as well as recapping any kind of key news events from this week and how it filters in to market moves. On this weekend show, we're going to do a lot of recapping news events, data from this week, because it was a fairly busy week, all gearing up for next week with the Fed midweek, and who knows if they're going to pause or hike again. We will find out soon. In the first half of this weekend show, we are chatting with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, we're recording this on Wednesday, so let's talk about a couple central bank meetings that have already happened and some that actually surprised the markets with a rate hike. We had the RBA and the Bank of Canada both hike rates this week by 25 basis points. The RBA was a bit more expected, but the Bank of Canada, it caught some people off guard. More and more what I was seeing in Canada with the news sources, it almost felt like they were trying to prep everybody for this rate hike. And sure enough, it came and the Bank of Canada reiterated that they are still going through a form of QT. Now, Jesse, how important are these smaller central banks, but the fact that they both hiked rates and the Bank of Canada hiked rates after being paused for a couple meetings?
Well, from my perspective, it puts more pressure on the Fed. I think all of these central banks are under pressure to appear as if they are doing enough to combat inflation, to actually bring it in a sustainable way, right? There's a history of central banks doing enough potentially to bring in inflation on a cyclical basis, but not to do enough to stem a potential, you know, rise in inflation over a longer period of time. And so I think that, you know, and Jay Powell's talked about this, that, you know, the risk is not doing enough. And, you know, that's the biggest risk right now. And so I think when, you know, for right now, so long as they're, you know, markets are fine and financial stability looks okay, we don't have problems in the regional banks anymore, you know, the Fed, you know, and central banks generally will feel pressure to err on the side of tightening too much in order to really address that issue of secular inflation.
Well, Jesse, with so many expectations based around what the Fed can do and what other central banks can do, the markets have kind of been in a little bit of a limbo. We have seen the general U.S. equities trending higher as of late, and we have seen the commodity sector a little under pressure. But some of that's because we've seen interest rates rise and the dollar rise. What do you make of rates going higher along with the greenback lately?
Well, I think, you know, from my perspective, the bond market, you know, should have been rallying over the past few months more than it has. Right, we saw a peak in rates a few months ago, but bonds haven't really been able to rally. If you look at things like the copper to gold ratio, I look at, you know, the cyclically sensitive sectors within the stock market. You look at like retail and material sectors have been so weak relative to the S&P 500 that it points to a, you know, real slowdown in the economy, potentially heading for recession. That should be bullish for bonds. We should see rates probably come down on that news. The fact that rates have not been coming in and a day like today, you know, rates are actually rising again, it suggests to me that the Treasury market is more concerned about liquidity right now than fundamentals. And that, you know, is simply the fact that the Treasury, now that the debt ceiling has been lifted, the Treasury has tons of supply coming to market. And, you know, that's probably going to lift interest rates in the short term. So, yeah, that creates demand for dollars, because if the Treasury is going to sell $1 trillion worth of T-bills, you're probably going to have to pay close to 6% interest on those. And that's very attractive, I think, to a lot of different investors.
Do you think that's a good balance, though? If investors can get around 6% on Treasury bills, gives them another alternative for their portfolio, but understanding that they don't want to just go all in on treasury bills. So investors are in a way kind of balanced here in treasuries, but then also in really just a select few stocks in the market.
Well, I think, you know, it's a big question, right? We've seen the stock market rally significantly, basically on the back of the seven big tech names, you know, the biggest tech names in the market, the Apples, Microsofts, you know, Nvidias of the world. So that's created a really poor underlying breadth condition in the stock market, right? Where these seven or eight stocks have done really, really well. And the rest of the market has actually done fairly poorly. Like I mentioned a minute ago, retail, especially poorly, but, you know, material stocks, transportation stocks, a lot of these, you know, cyclically sensitive sectors have been very, very, very soft. Now, I think you can tie in that breadth dynamic, that weak breadth, along with the liquidity situation. And this is something that, you know, Walter Diemer, who's a technical analyst who's been around markets for a very long time, wrote about this. And hat tip to Helene Meiser for pointing this out last week. But he pointed out that, you know, in bull markets, vigorous bull markets are kind of characterized by large quantities of money flowing in, so large that it puts stocks up almost across the board. You see everything go up together. That's a sign of really healthy breadth, really healthy liquidity in the market. When you get to kind of the tail end of a rally or a bull market, you see breadth wane, right? Fewer and fewer stocks going up. And that's basically a reflection of less liquidity in the market. And I think that's exactly what's going on, is we've had this kind of counter trend in liquidity where, you know, the Treasury had to draw down that TGA, the Treasury General Account, because they ran up against the debt ceiling. And the Fed stepped in to rescue the regional banks, and that boosted the balance sheet in a short period of time. Those two liquidity measures helped the stock market rally and risk assets generally. But now those are shifting, right? The Treasury now has to go sell, you know, refill the account. I guess they want to, you know, be up to about $500 billion in that TGA by the end of this month, or at least $400 billion. And the rescue of a regional banking sector is essentially done, and the Fed has unwound that expansion of the balance sheet. It's right back down to where it was before that. So liquidity is shifting. I think that when you look at breadth in the context of liquidity, it helps to understand what's going on. There's less money flowing into the stock market generally. That's being reflected in the very weak breadth numbers that we're seeing.
Well, and Jesse, we flagged the weak breadth for a long time on the show, just because you're seeing that narrow leadership hold up the indexes. But when you look at, you know, the S&P 490, the other 490 stocks compared to the top 10, it paints a lot different picture. When you look at the Russell 1000 or the Russell 2000, the small caps, it paints a lot different picture, or some of those other sectors you outlined. So it seems like a very bifurcated market where people are piling into mega cap tech stocks almost as a safe haven in uncertain waters, but the rest of the market's not telling that story. And we see that same mirror image in economic data, where when you look at the strong jobs report, that seems to be what everybody's piled into as the, hey, we're not heading towards a recession. And there's a few other economic indicators that were positive, such as some of the consumer confidence and some of the consumer spending. But there's other reports showing consumer spending flat, that credit card debt is piling on, that manufacturing is still slow, the commercial real estate's rolling over. So are we getting ready to head into a recession in the second half of this year, as so many messaged, or are we closer to that soft landing? Are people right that the jobs and labor data is so strong that we're probably not going to see a recession?
Well, it's funny that people are pointing to the labor market as an indicator that we're not in recession, because the labor market is famously a lagging economic indicator, right? By the time recession is reflected in labor, you're already well into recession, and it's already well reflected in the prices of risk assets. So by the time we get the unemployment rate above 4%, you know, on an average, whatever 3-month average or 6-month average, whatever economists like to look at, stock prices will already be significantly lower. That's just the nature of the beast, is by the time lagging indicators already show it, the stock market is a leading economic indicator. But I would say, as Stan Druckenmiller famously said, it's the inside of the stock market is the best economic predictor that he's ever seen. That's, you know, quoting Stan. So it's not just what the stock market is doing, the major stock market averages. It's what's the inside of the stock market? What's the relative performance of these cyclically sensitive sectors, like I mentioned before. And one of the ones, you know, he mentioned in this his quote is the Russell 2000. What's the relative performance of small cap stocks, relative performance of retail, transportation, all these things. And it's been absolutely terrible. To me, that's a very clear sign that, you know, the economy is not showing any sign of bottoming. For me, I'd be looking for those sectors to be leading us out of an important low in the stock market, right? You'd want to see booming, you know, retail leading. You'd want to see small caps leading, and we're seeing just the opposite. So I think that what we've seen is this, we're trending lower in the fundamental economic data. We're trending lower in earnings. And there aren't signs of a bottom yet. In fact, just the opposite. All these leading indicators suggest that we're still headed lower. And so, you know, people who are trying to time a bottom are probably, you know, by buying stocks and buying into these, essentially, you know, these tech stocks they think are, you know, insulated from recession, are probably making a bad bet.
Could they also just be betting on the fact that sometimes markets simply just diverge from the underlying economic fundamentals, and maybe this recession that everyone's been waiting for has taken so long to develop that, you know what, they're going to put their money to work somewhere, so why not put it into the broad averages or simply just park it in the tech stocks?
Yeah, I mean, if you traded through the 2002 to 2002 period, you saw people do this time and time again. We had so many rallies where the stock market rallied, you know, NASDAQ rallied 20 to 30%. And everybody thought, oh, this is the bottom. And then the economic data continued to trend lower. And it turned out it wasn't the bottom. And stock prices not only, you know, took out those previous lows. They not only gave back all their gains, they took out the previous low and went on to make lower lows. And so I think, you know, what's happened is there's some recency bias, where people think what, you know, their idea of a bear market is the 2009 experience, or it's the 2020 experience. It's a brief but sharp crash or deep correction in stock prices, and then an immediate rebound and move to new highs. Now, that was exactly what happened in 2020 and in 2008, 2009. It took a little bit longer, but there was a V bottom in the stock market back then. And that's what people look back to and expect that's what's going to happen again. But that's not the case with the typical bear market. The typical bear market and economic recession is more drawn out. And there are false dawns where people get excited about trying to play the potential for a bottom in the economic data and get ahead of it. But I think we're, you know, traders are being, you know, who are playing that trade are way too optimistic, that it's way too early to see any potential signs of a bottom for earnings or the economy in the near future.
Well, Jesse, another point that you've drilled home in some of the pieces you've written deals with, you know, the potential of an earnings recession and that we're already in one. And when you look at just how the first quarter earnings reports went, you know, a lot of publicity was given to some of the bigger companies, but when you dove under the hood, I think it was something like 75% of the companies had about a negative 10% earnings. And so it wasn't a pretty picture when you look at the majority of businesses. And when you look at some of the PE ratios we're seeing, especially, you know, we've highlighted on the AI craze that NVIDIA was up over a 200 PE ratio. It's now come down to just a minuscule 197 PE ratio. When you look at these earnings ratios, they're pricing companies for earnings forever, you know, to the sky is the limit. And it doesn't seem like anybody cares about these valuations. And you brought up some other statistics involving the M score and some other things to us off mic that I'd love you to unpack about how you're viewing the potential earnings recession building speed as the year develops and moving into next year.
Yeah, well, the forward operating PE ratio of the S&P 500 is about 20 times right now. So stocks trade about 20 times operating earnings. Over the past 10 years, you know, the average has been about 17. And that's based on the analyst estimates of the forward 12-month earnings for the S&P 500. Now, you have to so we're essentially, you know, 4 points above average right now in terms of valuations. But you also have to look at that's based on analyst estimates, which expect earnings to be bottoming this quarter and then begin rising significantly over the next several quarters. So if earnings do that, right, then stocks are potentially have already priced that in, right, a dramatic bottom and rebound in earnings. Now, the problem is if earnings aren't bottoming right now as we speak, if earnings are going to continue lower, and there's a number of indicators, you know, like you mentioned, the M score and things that suggest that they're headed lower, then it's going to turn out stocks are significantly overvalued. Because if earnings go down another, you know, 10, 15, 20% instead of rise 10, 15, 20%, and then you put a 17 multiple on those lower earnings figures, you're talking about something like 3,000 on the S&P 500 instead of, you know, 4,200, 4,300 where we are today. And that's a major difference. It just shows you the potential for disappointment. Now, to come back to those, I guess, leading indicators of earnings, you know, there's several you could look at. That M score is one. Is basically just a measure of earnings quality. And it hit in this last quarter, it hit a 40-year high in terms of the probability of earnings manipulation. And this measure always rises, you know, heading into a recession, because what it reflects is companies feeling the pressure about, you know, slowing top-line growth, rising costs, you know, really pressuring earnings. And so they start you manipulating different accounting things that they can manipulate to make earnings look better than they otherwise are. For example, you know, Google in its last quarter extended the depreciation duration of, you know, a lot of their cloud assets and things like that, which boosts earnings in the short term, but it doesn't reflect, you know, the trend in the underlying business currently. So when a bunch of companies are doing these types of accounting gimmicks, it's a sign that we're potentially in the early stages of an earnings recession. Another, I guess, confirming measure of that would be the gap between NIPA profits and S&P 500 profits. When you see that gap widen to the extent that it has in the last couple of quarters, it's always a sign that we're heading into recession, because NIPA profits reflect real corporate profits, right? Not manipulated. And S&P 500 profits are, you know, manipulated, you know, that reflected in that M score. So we see NIPA profits peaked, you know, a year ago and have been rolling over significantly. S&P 500 profits always follow. This is always, you know, also a really good, I think Charles Gav has showed this is always a really good indicator of recession too, confirming a lot of other leading indicators. So there are all types of things like this to show that markets are pricing in a bottom for earnings right now and then rising again through the end of the year. A second half recovery is essentially what analysts are forecasting. Now, if that doesn't happen and earnings continue lower, there's going to have to be a significant repricing in stocks.
Okay, so it really sounds like, Jesse, you're thinking the second half of the year is going to be quite tough for the stock market broadly. The broad averages should come down quite a bit. Will it be a fast move? Will it be a grinding down move? And quite frankly, is that money going to rotate anywhere? Or is it just going to go to money heaven?
That's a good question. I haven't heard that money heaven before, but that's a good one, because that's typically what happens in bear markets. People ask, well, where did that money go from the dot-com bust? Well, it went to money heaven. But I do think we are seeing a rotation. The rotation we've seen this year was out of, you know, it's been out of energy. We've seen record weekly flows into tech funds, right? This is mind-boggling to me, that the flows we've seen recently are bigger than anything we saw in 2020, 2021, during that kind of meme stock blow off and the speculative euphoria in 2021. We've actually surpassed that. The amount of call buying that we've seen in the S&P 500 and in Nvidia and, you know, some of these popular things is hitting records. So the speculative euphoria is back. And when that goes away, yes, stock prices are going to roll over significantly. I do think we are in more of, as I mentioned, we're not in that type of a 2008-9 crash. We're in more of kind of a rolling bear market. So I do think we could see the rotation back the way we saw last year. Money this year has flown out of energy into tech, and I think we could see it flow back the other way, back into that rotation that kind of characterized 2022.
Well, Jesse, in lieu of all these economic factors, something like the precious metals sector like that has held up pretty well. Gold price still kind of either side of 2000 for the last few months. And all things considered, it's a very respectable price, still near the all-time highs, still trying to break out. But when you look at the gold equities, a little bit different story. They're not responding quite as well as the metals. But all things considered, gold has held up well, to a lesser extent, silver. How do you think that plays forward if the markets were to correct, if we do get into a recession or contractionary period? Do you think that that would pull gold down with it, or would that be a tailwind to give gold a boost in that kind of an environment?
Well, you know, I've been watching very closely a price analog. It's fascinating to me how closely gold over the past 3-4 years has fit the 2015 to 2018-19 cycle, right? You know, when gold peaked in around, you know, June, July, August, something like that of 2020, that was really similar to the time when, you know, the Fed started raising interest rates at the end of 2015-16. And I guess the Powell pivot in January 2019 really lines up very nicely with the potential for a pause or skip that we're seeing today. So this corrective pattern in gold is almost identical to the corrective pattern we saw from 2016 through 2018, when Jay Powell was trying to play Paul Volcker back then. I don't know if you remember, in October of 2018, Fed funds rate, I think, was 3, and he said, we're nowhere near neutral, right? Which, you know, made everybody think, oh my gosh, we have tons of rate hikes to come. You know, 3 months later, famous Powell pivot, we're not going to hike anymore, and gold price took off after that. And then, you know, obviously a few months later, September of 2019, we had the repo fiasco, and gold kind of anticipated that. And that's when the Fed had to stop quantitative tightening. And from there, you know, gold price went from 1300 to 2000. So I think we're approaching a similar period here where the Fed is really, we're hitting an important phase of quantitative tightening right now, where the Fed has not, you know, has ended its assistance for regional banks. We're going into new territory for quantitative tightening. The Treasury's rebuilding the TGA. So this represents a big liquidity suck out of markets. And I think we probably could see some financial stability concerns crop up. I don't know if it's going to be, you know, something to do with this basis trade again, where hedge funds have leveraged up, futures versus cash treasuries via the repo market. I don't know what it could be, but we could see some kind of financial stability thing come up in the next couple of quarters, perhaps, that would force the Fed again to back off of quantitative tightening. If that happens, you're going to see gold do what it did last time, which, you know, like I said, went from 1300 to 2100. You know, obviously, we're starting from a higher base this time. You know, we're starting from 1900-ish, but you could easily see gold move $600-$700 higher if you see a financial stability issues start cropping up.
Is that finally going to help the gold stocks? Because even the majors tend to be struggling right here, and they're just not getting to the same levels that they were even when gold was threatening to break out over the last few years.
Well, to me, that's a sentiment signal. You know, I've been buying energy stocks for the past 3 years heavily, and it's amazing to me that so many of these stocks still trade, even with the oil price where it's at now, right? These companies are still printing money. The free cash flow yield of the energy sector in the S&P 500 is well over 10%. And nobody wants to own it. Money's been flowing out of the energy sector into tech. But you got a 12%, 13% free cash flow yield in energy. The same thing is essentially true of these gold miners, that if the gold price is going to do that, their free cash flow of these companies is going to go through the roof, and investors are going to have to turn their attention to, you know, precious metals, miners, energy stocks, because if the Fed is unable to finish the job on inflation and really normalize the balance sheet this time in the face of, you know, significant inflationary pressures, then it suggests that, you know, gold prices and oil prices are way too low and are sustainably headed higher. That's very, very bullish for these companies in those sectors.
Jesse, any thoughts on Dr. Copper? You mentioned the copper to gold ratio. A lot of people see Dr. Copper as a good economic indicator. It's kind of been stagnant, not doing bad, not doing good, just kind of trending sideways along with a lot of the commodities. How do you see the base metals kind of led by Dr. Copper set up for the future?
You know, I mean, longer term, I don't know how anybody is, you know, can be anything but extremely bullish on the copper price. There's just, when you look at the manufacturing boom that's going on here in the United States right now as a factor of this push to reshore, semiconductor production and all these different things, you know, copper is probably the most important component of, transition to green energy. With the manufacturing boom and this transition to green energy and things, the demand for copper is only going to continue to grow. At the same time, production is horrible, right? I think the biggest copper producer in the world has seen its production decline 30% in the last few years, and they've said there are no new big copper mines coming on. So there's a big supply-demand mismatch in copper over the next few years. In the short term, right, copper prices are economically sensitive. They could, continue to correct for a time. But longer term, I think you have to be very bullish on copper.
All right, Jesse, we'll wrap it up here. Again, it's the second half of this year type of story, right? And we're not quite there. We have about just over three weeks to go until we're finally in that second half of this year. And, well, let's see how it all plays out. I know a lot of people are wondering what the Fed's going to do next week and just what this upcoming recession, if it does come, what it's going to look like and how it's going to take markets down, probably. But we'll see. Right now, boy, oh boy, market's still, I guess, remaining strong simply on the back of AI and tech, and everything else seems to just continue to drift lower. Jesse, thank you as always for your time. Great chatting with you. We'll chat next month. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.